Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Oh, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Linda, I'm sorry I missed you. Give me a call back when we get a chance. Sorry we had to take that break. Tony, he's got some issues with raised beds. Tony, let's talk about those raised bed issues real quickly.
Okay, Bill. I've been in this house since 2013, and since then I've taken down about 85 water oaks.
Ooh.
And I've struggled with trying to plant things on top of the roots, on top of the base, stinky mushrooms. And the latest ones I took down are about 10 feet apart, and I've got about maybe a foot of slope in the lot. And I'm just trying to raise the bed enough where I could plant maybe roses without dealing with all the roots. So I would only raise it as much as I need to.
Right.
So, and I thought maybe containing it would be the best place to make a bed. If I can do it on a slope, that's fine too.
Yeah, and that's good. So for the most part, you know, one of the problems we've got is this armillaria root rot. Check before you invest a lot in roses. Check to see, and I'm not really sure how susceptible roses are to that water oak root rot, the armillaria root rot. But if you're seeing those fungus come up, those really yellowy, yucky, cruddy looking fungus that get real gooey after a while, that's the armillaria, and it can infect a lot of living plants as well.
Okay.
Check on that, and I'll have to check on it, and I'll check on that next week to see if how susceptible roses are. Some plants are very susceptible. Some plants are only moderately susceptible. When you build the bed up, this won't eliminate the root rot at all. The root rot is in the soil. It's still going to be there. If you build the bed up, really, you really want to only build it up about 6 inches. Do it mostly with pine bark, with organic matter. It's what you want. Organic matter usually doesn't move, and if it does, you just put some pine straw over it, and it won't move at all. If you want to line it with something, you can then put if you're on a slope and you feel like you've got some acceleration in water as it moves down the slope, then it can be good to put a barrier there. And I would think modern treated wood is going to be fine. Modern treated wood. The older treated wood has arsenic. And the older, when did they switch over? But anything produced in
the 80s or something.
Yeah, well, it's much later. It was actually sometime close to the year 2000. But anything produced in the past 10 years should be just fine. So you're okay with that. I don't think that'll be any problem. And you know, when you line those beds, the primary purpose here is because you're on a slope. Think of it that way, and you can do it that way. So good. I wanted to hear about that, what you're planting there. The roses – so this is – Tony, this will be my challenge this week. Let me see what I can find about how susceptible it is to this oak root rot that we're now calling it, which is being spread by water oaks at an enormous rate. Never used to be a problem. It's another one of those things related to fire. It's really hilarious. Yeah. I mean, not hilarious. It's sad. But it's interesting to see, because we now have so many water oaks and they're spreading this disease. It never was a big problem before.
Yeah.
When
I first planted, when I first started cutting those, that was my first experience with that stinky mushroom thing. I thought I had dead animal in my yard.
Yeah.
They are terrible.
Well, that's a stinkhorn, and that's a little different. That's the pink one, right?
I can't remember now, but I haven't had that in the past few oaks that I've cut down.
Yeah, so the pink ones are harmless. They're not a problem at all. They only eat organic matter. That's I won't tell you what kind of mushroom it is, but it's a stinkhorn is what we call it, and it's harmless.
okay.
to anything else. In fact, it's good to have it. The, our malaria will be yellow, and some people call it honey fungus. It almost has the color of a kind of a honey-colored thing, but it's our malaria, and it's oak. It makes these big masses of yellowish, brownish mushrooms that are kind of gooey.
And, yeah, I've seen them too.
Yeah, so that's the R. malaria, and that's okay. what you need to worry about. And maybe your water oaks won't spread that R. malaria, but boy, it's just become really common now. But let me check on the roses, and call me back next week, and let's talk about it.
Thanks for taking my call.
All right, thanks, Tony. Let me grab Linda real quick, Charlie. She's been very patient. Linda, I'm listening. What's up?
Oh, good morning, Bill. I've got some plants that I didn't get finished planting back in the fall, and I'm just wondering if I can plant them now. Specifically, I've got a Peggy Martin climbing rose, a Confederate rose, a spirea, and a couple of other plants that have been in the pot for a long time, camellias that have been in the pot for a good long time. And I'm wondering, it's so pretty outside yesterday and today, and the ground is nice and soft. I was wondering if I'm jumping the gun on planting them now.
All of those plants are going to be just fine planted now. They're going to be much happier planted now. This may be this is an excellent time to plant. You know, fall, October, November is maybe the ideal time for planting for a lot of reasons, but it's December, January, and February are also great times. So it's still a great time to plant, and all of those plants are hardy. The only plants, and I say this every time, there are a couple of exceptions. Satsumas and other citrus I wouldn't plant until spring. But anything else, almost anything else, I'd go ahead and plant now.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, I heard you earlier saying that the amaryllis would survive in the ground, and I'm thinking, well, these are in the pots, and the ground is supposed to be warmer than what's in the pot. So
right.
I'm glad that you stated that, because it's so pretty outside. You just got to get out and do something.
Yeah, well, that's right. It is pretty. And you know, the temperatures here during winter are never a problem. Never a problem. The reason they don't plant during winter up north is because the ground is frozen.
Right.
And that creates problems for digging, and it creates problems for plants. But here, the ground never freezes, and so the plants really like it a whole lot better in the ground than they do in the pots. The one exception are citrus, and you know, I tell you, let the grower handle the citrus until spring. Buy your citrus in spring and plant it then.
Good idea. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I listen to you often, so
all right.
That's great.
All right, Linda, good to hear from you. Yeah, so Rusty, thank you for that. It's about 2003, I think that was. I think that was when the changeover occurred in the timber. So it went from arsenic based to borate based, copper and borate based chemicals, and those are safer. They're probably safer, probably. Jim, let's try to get one call in real quickly before our break here. Jim, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes. So good morning, Bill. I have an Alyssum parviflorum.
Uh-huh.
And the leaves are drooping on one of them, and it was doing fine during the summer, and others right next to it are doing fine.
You know, it sounds to me like... I mean, there's a lot of issues we could be looking at, but Alyssum is very sensitive to overwatering and to overly wet places, and particularly parviflorum would be. Is it possible that this one is a little bit wetter or planted a little bit deeper than some of the others?
Actually, it's a little bit higher than the others.
Okay. Well, then... you see any problems around the trunk? Does the trunk look okay?
Well, the trunk seems to be fine. I did lose one branch off of it, but right next to it is a little sprout that's coming out of the ground that's maybe 6-7 inches, and it's doing great. It's just this one that's about 4 feet tall is all the leaves just droop.
Yeah, so it sounds like there's something in the stem, that there's some damage in the trunk itself, and the roots are trying to rebuild. Send me a picture of the base of that plant, and send me a picture of the leaves of that plant, and let me take a look at it, and then you call me back. You can send me a picture of the same number that you called in, and let me take a look at it and see if I can see anything that seems suspicious. Is that okay?
One quick question.
Yep.
I also have got a needlepoint holly that, for some reason, the base of the leaves look very dark green, like a normal, but at the top, they're almost lime-colored green. And, like, the new growth has been lime-colored. Will that eventually transition to darker?
Yes, probably, almost certainly it will. And yes, so new growth is often very, very much lighter than the older growth, but it just is, and it should harden off soon. Is it putting on new growth now?
Yes, I mean, it looks real healthy. I mean, real full. I mean, lots of berries on there. It just, this is uncharacteristic for ones that I've planted. It's always all green, and this one just seems to be a lot of lime green right there at the top.
Yeah, so it's not a great time for it to be leafing out, and you really don't want it to be leafing out. I think it's premature to suggest that there's something wrong. Let's wait on it. Let's look at it again in spring. But that new growth may be damaged if it doesn't harden off pretty soon.
Okay.
Because it's coming out in winter, there may be some nutrient transfer issues that are occurring, and it's not like you need to fertilize it. You don't want to fertilize it, but it may not be moving nutrients as well through the whole plant as would normally occur if it were leafing out at a time when it was supposed to be leafing out, which is in spring. Let's just look at it. Let's come back and look at it again in spring. I think it'll probably recover.
All right, I'll get you a picture of that lithium.
All right, great. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Bill.
Hey, we got a lot of callers. Ooh, David, I'm going to get to you. Derek, Kitty, I'm coming.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Oh, we better get to work here. It's busy. We got a lot of phone calls. We got a lot of questions to answer. A lot of fun questions to answer. So Tony asked me, Tony down in Fowl River, he says, send me these beautiful pictures of cabbage. Man, they are beautiful. I'm jealous of people who grow great cabbage. I'll tell you, I don't grow great cabbage for a lot of reasons. I probably have given up too soon, but Tony's done a great job. They're beautiful cabbage. So a couple of questions with cabbage is you know, cabbage is not a cut and come again plant. Broccoli is, at least the broccoli varieties I recommend. When you cut a head of broccoli, you get other smaller heads around it, and those smaller heads actually may be better than the big head that's at the center. That's great. So you can keep harvesting broccoli over a long period. Kale, you know, you cut some leaves, more come back. That doesn't happen with cabbage. It doesn't happen with cabbage. I have seen people get a head, but it's not going to be – look, it just practically speaking, it doesn't happen. It's not useful. When you cut that head, that's it. There are some forms of cabbage that don't form heads as readily, and you can pick the leaves occasionally on the side. But with those cabbage, the classic cannonball cabbage with the closed head, with the white leaves on the interior, those cabbages, you get one go at each plant, and that's it. So, but Tony asked me, "Can what happens if you mix it with mustard greens?" Well, is it okay? Well, it's okay if you don't mind the cabbage leaves actually tasting better. Did I say that? Well, cabbage tastes good. Cabbage tastes good. It's got a good flavor, and you ought to enjoy that flavor, but mustard can add something to it. That could be really good. I would add the mustard later in the cooking process so you get more of that mustardy bite. Don't add it right away. Did I tell you how I cook cabbage? Start the cabbage, and this is an old recipe I got from the Black Belt. Somebody showed me the Black Belt, how they cook cabbage years and years ago when I was a kid. You take a pot, and you cut the cabbage up, slice it into pieces, and put some butter in the bottom of the pot, and then stir-fry the cabbage in the bottom of the pot. Don't put any water in there. Just stir-fry it first. And then when those leaves begin to wilt, put some pepper and salt in there, and then put a little bit of water. I mean just a little more than a thimbleful of water. Just a little bit of water, then put the lid on it. And at that point, so I would stir fry it, and then I might stir fry the mustard greens in towards the end, and then put a little water in there. It'd be really good. Just a little. Really good. Really good thing to do. So, David, let's talk about this bees and honey thing, shall we?
Yes, we shall.
So here's the thing. David is going to get some bees. And the dogs are not going to – the dogs are really going to enjoy those bees, David.
those bees bite back, though, so I don't know how much.
That's right. So it's going to be interesting. But so he's going to get some bees, and think about getting some bees. And if the dogs don't get in the way. So here's the thing. What kind of plants do you plant? At the scale of a normal garden, there's not a lot you can do to really get a lot of honey for your plants. But let me tell you what makes good honey, the really great honeys that we have. We got a lot of, we produce a lot of good honeys. And the fun thing is the bees will get most of their, almost all of their nectar will come from off your property. And no matter what you plant, 70, 80% is going to come off your property. Because you're just not going to be able to produce enough on a small city property to really keep them busy. And there's going to be different times of year when it's really good. Traditionally in West Mobile and in the Pine Hills region, that early crop Cirilla. Racemosa, the thing we call what do we call Cirilla? It's a Cirilla racemosa is, I'll think of the name here in just a minute. Tie Tie, thank you. Tie Tie honey is one of the best honeys out there. It's absolutely delicious. It produces a great honey in usually in March. That's one of the best early honeys. Later on, it can depend on where you are. Poplar honey can be very good. Tupelo honey, as it turns out, it can actually be quite good too. And when the water tupelo and the black tupelo and the swamp tupelo start blooming, and they all bloom at different times, they can begin to dominate honey, and that can be very good. And people who grow honey actually take their honey off so that they can get a relatively pure version. So if they know one of these big plants is about to start flowering in their area, boom, they take all the honey off the hives. So that the honey that comes in is all from these trees, and it's really pure and really tastes great. And then there are a ton of wildflowers that all can make a real difference in how that honey tastes. And I just like the general wildflower honey that I'm getting from a lot of places. But Tie Tie would be the tree that I would plant. It's a great tree. Tie Ties make great honey, and you can buy the Tie Ties, Cirillas, and the other Tie Tie, which also may contribute. I got to figure that buckwheat Tie Tie may also contribute, but both of them can be very good. Another one that's very good, which is going to be harder to find, is the... is oxydendron sourwood. Sourwood trees make really good honey, and we have a lot of sourwoods in West Mobile too. So am I making it worse or better, David?
No, you're making it fine, because I got a city park that's, you know, like a block away from the house, and that's surrounded by some wooded areas, so I'm sure my bees will go off to wherever they need to go to to find the pollen to make the honey. So I just wanted to make sure that there was enough food for them to nearby you know, so they wouldn't have to go off too far.
Yeah, and generally there will be. And even at Mobile Botanical Gardens, we've selected for sourwood. Trees that don't contribute are water oaks. they are, you know, you think I don't like water oaks. I actually like water oaks. It's just that we've made monsters of them by the way we treat the woods and the and our places around our houses. But water oaks in their place are just fine, but they don't contribute to honey. A lot of the trees, live oaks, don't contribute to honey. None of the oaks do. And none of the pines contribute to honey. But trees with big flowers, and particularly things like or moderately large flowers, kind of bee-sized flowers, things like sourwood and things like tupelo, the black gums, they really can make great honey.
Well, what about my magnolia tree that I have in the back, will that
No,
would that be?
You know, I don't think so. Magnolias are very old, and this is fun. You're going to get me distracted here, David. Magnolias are very old. They're evolutionarily very old. They predate a lot of other trees, and they're pollinated by beetles.
Okay.
Does that sound glamorous?
Oh, that sounds just lovely.
Yeah, so they're pollinated by beetles. Isn't that weird? So the bees make no use of magnolias. They don't make really good use of rhododendrons either. That's another famous story. There's some question as to whether rhododendrons may actually produce toxic honey. I don't think so, and rhododendrons include azaleas, probably not. But they make some use of it, but they don't make famous honey, but sourwood, some of those other trees that I mentioned, the poplars, the tie-ties, those are the famous honey producers here. And then there are lots of wildflowers. I mean, you can't control where they're going. So they're going to find lots of different wildflowers on small plants that, you know, it'll be even hard to figure out what it is. And last thing, because you're going to get me way distracted here, but it's fun, is kudzu. And there's still some kudzu out there, and they'll hit kudzu like crazy when kudzu blooms, and the honey will come back purple.
Wow. I might have to try that.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, David, good to hear from you. Dan, I'm coming back. Derek, hold on.
That's often remembered so many times that my memories are warm. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
It's official now. We've had a show. Tiny Tim is the imprimatur, I'm told, I should say.
What was that word?
Yeah. It is the symbol of our show. It is that that we've really had a show. Hey, let's move on here. Is Confederate jasmine good for bees? You know, I think probably not. But I could be wrong. I'm going to look it up too. Now that you've asked, I don't think I would want Confederate jasmine honey. I'm not saying they won't utilize it. I don't think that it is the kind of flower that would be designed to attract bees. I think that's more of a moth flower, but I'm going to look it up. I'm going to see. It just doesn't look right for a bee flower to me. I mean, I'm interested now. I'm going to figure that one out. Trey, we'll figure it out. Boy, I better get to some of these callers who've been holding on. Should I go to Derek first? Derek, I'm listening.
What's going on?
How are you?
Question real quick.
Yeah.
All right, so they planted some kind of citrus hybrids, like lemon hybrids, a while back. Never got pruned. These things look like trees almost at this point. So when can I prune them?
Yeah, well, and that was the conversation I had earlier in the show.
I know, I missed it, that's why I called.
And here's the thing. I never recommend pruning citrus.
Really?
No, because every time you prune a citrus, and your lemon, which is a Meyer's lemon, probably, yeah. It's a hybrid between an orange and a lemon, its hardiness is determined by the thickness of its canopy.
Oh, okay, cool.
There it is. And you know what? You're going to get a winter that's going to knock it back again. And you know, and there it is. And that will do it for you. Don't prune a Meyer's lemon. I just don't recommend it.
You just made my job easier, actually, because I wasn't looking forward to doing no A-frame ladder. You know?
No. So just let it go. You got to figure out how to pick those leaves that are the fruit that are up at the top of the tree. That's another question. We should talk about that someday.
I've already got that figured out. You know what I mean? That's just one of them long poles, man.
You got it.
I just gotta. What did Mark Twain say? How do you get collars out of a tree? What was that saying? Something about you gotta. You gotta shake the tree till the collars fall out. You ever remember?
Yeah, I don't know.
All right, thanks, Bill.
All right, good to hear from you. All right, Derek. Hey, yeah, just simple story. I don't recommend pruning citrus. There it is. It creates more problems than it solves. Dan, thanks for holding on, bud.
How you doing, Mr. Bill?
Good. So you got a lot of questions. Did you send me this question about the weeds?
Yes, sir. Some kind of little. It's my neighbor cleared off a spot in her yard. It's just under a live oak, kind of on a raised area, and she pulled all the weeds up and put a tarp down, kind of a weed tarp, covered it with pine straw. And then noticed there were some weeds kind of growing up around the rim of the tarp. I looked underneath it. It's basically a carpet of this, some kind of creeper.
Yep. So weed. The creeper is, and let me, so the creeper is, I suspect, a tropical day flower that's become a little bit invasive here. And it loves shady places. It does real well in shady places. And so it would love growing up under that tarp. It's getting enough light on the edge to stay alive. It's going to persist there. So that's the first thing. That I don't remember the exact name for it, but it's in the dayflower family. It's a Comelinaceae. It's Comelina. It's related to Tritoscandia. It may not be a Tritoscandia, but you don't care about all that. It's a tropical dayflower that has become the weedy here. It does real well in shade. It's obnoxious. But here's the second thing, and so this is a great story, and I want to be able to tell it right now, and it's very important. Weed barriers make weeds worse. The worst thing you can do to control weeds is to put out a weed barrier, because you will have weeds that will be impossible to extract. You'll be tearing that weed barrier to pieces. The best thing she can do at this point is to remove the weed barrier. Of course, she's still going to have to figure out how to deal with the Comelinaceae, with the little dayflower, the tropical dayflower that's taking over the bed. But we can talk about that. There are a lot of ways of dealing with that are reasonably productive. But it's right now that weed barrier is going to make that weed worse. Eventually. Right now, it's only at the edges, but eventually that weed barrier is going to provide a perfect habitat for weeds on top of it. And this is the inevitability of using a weed barrier here, and those weeds will penetrate it. Oh, it's going to be a mess.
Yeah, I told her. it'll be nice to just let play the podcast back for her
And so tell her if we need to talk about it. You tell her to call in, and we'll talk about it. She tried to do the right thing, and somebody, it's not her fault that people sell stuff that doesn't work, and that they deceive us by doing that, and they deceive us terribly by pretending that these weed barriers work. They may work in Minnesota a little bit better, and I could get into reasons why, but. They don't work here.
Well, yeah, I appreciate that, and I'll go and relay the information. We'll probably do a little something with it later today. But my second question was, we called last week. I called last week. We were doing the seed, the New Year's seed resolutions, right?
Right. Yeah.
Well, I placed my order, and I want you to help me figure out how exactly. I need to go about starting these up from seed. And so I've got six or seven different kinds of tomatoes. I got Juliet, Carmelo, Sun Gold, Super Sweet 100, and then another one called Patio Choice Yellow Hybrid.
All right,
they
good.
Just looked cool.
Good. So we need to get them started, and so there's several ways to do it. You know, I would use a container because it's a little easier to manage the moisture. If you use a really big container, it's hard to keep the soil warm. This is a problem. It's something you got to think about. If you use too small a container, it's hard to keep it watered sufficiently. So I use these little six packs that have the soil depth is about as deep as your, not quite as deep as your thumb. Okay?
That's what I have.
Yep. That's
I
good.
That size. Yes, sir.
And then if you can swing it, buy yourself a heating mat.
Okay.
That makes all the difference. And they make heating mats designed, and you can get them on all those places where you get stuff nowadays. And it's just a heating mat. It's somewhat better if it has a temperature control, but even if it doesn't have a temperature control, it's still going to work just fine. But a heating mat makes all the difference this time of year in germinating tomatoes. So get some good potting soil, put your tomato seed in there, put a little heating flat under it. At night, if you want to, you can put a towel over the top just to keep the heat from escaping from the container. It's a little dangerous to do that during the day. I would just do that at night. The other thing is I would put a towel under the heating mat so that the heating mat doesn't transfer its heat down to the surface below it. It serves as an insulating blanket so that most of the heat gets transmitted to the surfaces above it.
Just, right.
There you go. Physics thing. So,
right.
And you do that, and those tomatoes are going to sprout incredibly fast. And then you're going to need to give them light, good sunlight. They actually don't need sunlight to sprout, but they do need sunlight once they've sprouted. Once you see those, and if it's cold outside, just keep them in the window during the day. But most days it's going to be warm enough. Even today it was cold last night, but today it'll be fine outside on these sunny things. Put them out with a heating mat. Leave them outside on the heating mat. If it's in the temperatures are in the 60s or 70s, just put them outside. But give them plenty of sunlight as you can. Bring them inside at night because it is going to be too cold at night almost every night this time of year for those plants.
Right.
But give them plenty of sunlight or find a window where they get plenty of sunlight if you want to. But keep that heating mat going underneath the plants for just a little while until they get a little more size and until the temperature gets a little better.
Okay, sounds good. And then, so for the tomatoes now, I've also got some peppers, sugar snaps, and then I got the zucchino replicante, the trombocino, and I got some gagutsa.
Those are to be planted later, but the sugar snaps you need to plant right now, now. And the tomatoes, it's a good time to plant them. The sugar snaps, get them in the ground as soon as possible. This is the time to plant. This is the best time to plant sugar snaps here along the Gulf Coast. Okay. This would be my day. If my sugar snap peas were here, I would be home planting them right now. Dead gummit, the postman didn't come with them. So,
I'm still waiting to.
Yeah, but sugar snaps, now is the time. Now is the time. The rest of that stuff, you got a long ways to go before that needs to be planted. Most of it's planted in the ground. The peppers will start early. Give me a call in 2 weeks and let's talk about those peppers.
All right, Ms. Finch, you got it. I appreciate the help.
All right, Dan, good to hear from you. Oh, and if I got time to talk to Catherine. Catherine, good. I'm listening.
Hey, Bill.
Hey.
I have two limelight hydrangeas, and I've had them in the ground for about 4 or 5 years, and they have done nothing at all, ever. So I've decided they don't have enough sun where they are. And
my husband and I were
out digging yesterday and realized it was a perfect time for digging in the yard because the ground is soft and kind of damp.
Yeah.
Is this a good time to move them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. A perfect time to move them. Perfect time. You couldn't have. You almost couldn't pick a better time. I think you'll be just fine. And how long have they been in that place?
I think 4 or 5 years.
but they haven't grown much. So probably the root system is probably going to be pretty well contained. You'll
they
be fine.
They have grown bigger. They just don't bloom, and they don't look healthy.
Okay. All right. All right. Let's, but now's a good time to move them. You know, I have thought that, I have seen a lot of people be very successful with limelight hydrangeas. I've heard a couple of complaints about them recently. I figured if McDonald's can do limelight hydrangeas, anybody can do limelight hydrangeas.
Yeah.
There may be some issues with these limelight hydrangeas. I'm going to check on that. But it sounds like if you think there's too much shade, probably there is too much shade.
Okay. Well, I read maybe in Southern Living that they bloom on new wood, so you should cut them back in winter. Is that a good idea or not?
So they do bloom on new wood. The simple way to prune all hydrangeas is each summer, you can do it in spring, you can do it in summer. I would recommend doing it in summer. After they bloom, cut out, when they've through their peak bloom, cut out the two or three largest stems all the way to the ground. And with the limelights, maybe only one or two. But one or two of the largest stems, and that's the way to prune them. There really isn't a benefit in terms of flowering to pruning every year, really. And most hydrangeas don't need pruning every year. But if you prune, you don't want to prune the tops. You want to prune the base. And you're taking out the old fat stems. Because they're
now,
the
I
ones
have done that. Yeah, you know, I heard you talk about doing that before, and I've done that with my French,
common hydrangeas, common blues. Uh-huh. And so it works the same way with these hydrangeas. You'll do it the same way. And you know, the truth is you can almost do that any time of year. Really, it doesn't much matter if you do it that way. But I would wait until spring or summer after they've bloomed and pruned. But I don't think I would do it right now.
Okay.
And this plant, because you're moving it, is going to need every bit of those stems because that's where the carbohydrates are stored that it's going to use to build new roots and produce new leaves. So don't prune it now.
Okay.
Okay. Catherine?
All right. Well, that sounds great. We'll go ahead and move them then, and thank you so much.
All right. Well, call me back if you run into any problems. All right.
Thank you.
You got to take a break.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face. Okay, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Lots of questions to finish up with here. Sean, you may be disappointed in that plant. There are, and I can't be sure because I can't see close enough. There are lots of lookalikes out there with leaves that are palmate that look like the shape of your hand. There are some infamous plants that have that shape. But there are also some not so infamous plants that probably you would never want to smoke, like Cleomys. That also have that shape. From what I can tell, that isn't, shall we say, smokable. Dan's got some melaton, and he wants to know how to extract the seed. Well, you don't. That's the cool thing about melaton. You actually put that whole fruit in a pot, and the seed germinates and puts a radical down out of the whole fruit. It's the weirdest thing in the whole world. That's how it works. Now, he got these from his aunt, and you can go ahead and put them in pots now. What we don't know is, did your aunt grow them in her garden? If she did, these are a treasure. If she got them from the grocery store, they're probably not going to produce for you. And we can tell you why. They may grow, but they won't produce. And David Hubble can come on and we can talk about that at some point. But if she got these from a garden, they're a real treasure. You should keep them. You should put them in a pot. Just lay them on their side with that little crease down in the pot, and they will actually produce a root, a radical, that will develop pretty soon, amazingly quickly. And you can go ahead and do that now. Now's the time to do that. Just feel free to do it. Do not put it outside yet, but let that radical develop. Once it starts getting leaves, you're going to need to give it some sun. But we'll talk about it when you get leaves and when you get that radical for the root developing. Thomas, I'm listening.
Happy New Year, Bill.
Happy New Year to you.
Bill, listen, I think your postman, he hasn't delivered your seeds because he's too busy moving his tomato plants inside the house and outside, giving them the heating blanket. And tucking them in at night with a towel.
All right.
The guy's too busy to deliver your seeds.
So I got to quit giving advice so people will bring my seeds to me, is what you're telling
me. I know. Gee, we should notify the people in California and Florida to produce the tomatoes. You know, they need eating blanket.
Yeah. Yep. So there it is.
Hey, Sip and Chew, they're talking about bottled grapes.
Yep.
And they were talking about the corks in the champagne. Well, champagne bottles, I wrote a paper about it once, and you will find on the top of the champagne bottle, you know, that cage metal that encases the cork. Well, every one of those, if you take that loop, the metal loop, and turn it counterclockwise, six half turns, it disengages the cork. Six, and all of them do that for some reason, six half turns. And you take the towel off your arm, you know, if you're a butler or something, and you hold that cork, and you hold the cork after the six. I usually only go turn it five half turns, and then grab the cork with the towel, and you turn the bottle, not the cork, and you'll be successful every time.
All right. Well, you know, the other night, it was interesting. This is interesting because we shouldn't get too distracted by this. But the other night I had a bottle of a Belgian ale.
Yes.
And for some reason I decided to undo the little wire cage and we decided we weren't going to drink it. And I thought, boy, is this going to pop on its own? It didn't. But yes. So I wondered how many turns it would take before it would loosen. The cork held in there, in spite of the fact that the bottle got carried around many miles. But yeah. Thomas, it's good to hear from
you. Yes, I'm here.
Yeah.
I couldn't hear you, sir.
Yep. Can you hear me now? Yeah,
I can hear you now.
Yep. So it's so that's an interesting thing there. This
okay,
thing.
Well, I just didn't want to stray too far, but a point of interest. It's a holiday. People deal with corks.
That's right, they do. So what do you do with the little – the question is, what do you do with the little wire cage when you're through with
plants.
It? I was thinking there's got to be something you can use that little wire cage for. I'm not sure what it is.
Love your show.
All right.
Listen all the time.
Good to hear from you, Thomas. Hey, so Dan tells me that these melitol – okay, now the mystery is solved. And they're beautiful-looking melitol. They came from John Olive, ultimately, and those came from David Hubble. And John Olive has been growing these out. So now, Dan, you are entrusted. You now have a big responsibility, and that is to keep these melitons going and to share them. And so it will be your responsibility to share them. These are indeed rare and important melitons. They're Gulf Coast melitons, which are very hard to find. David brought them to us. David Hubble brought them to us. He shared them with John Olive. John Olive shared them with some of the staff. Some of those staff are now, you have some of those, and Dan now has the great sacred meliton trust that he has to maintain. So, Dan, if you we have to make sure you do this right. So we're going to have – I'll tell you what. Next week, I'm going to try to get David on the show, David Hubble on the show, And we're going to talk about starting melatonin. So we're going to just start about it. We're going to talk about all the details. We're going to do that on next week's show. It'll be a great time. David Preston is still very interested in lots of issues. He wants to know about does honeysuckle vines make good honey pollen? You know, David, I don't think so, and we can talk about that for various reasons. Too long a tube. The tube is too long. Hey, we'll come back next week. We got lots more to talk about. It's good to hear from you guys this week.
With Gugutsa, I want to be. Cause Gugutsa is so crazy over me. Gugutsa grows in Italy. They love it on the farm. It's something like zucchini flavored with Italian charm. I call my